because Lamuel, welcome. As well as the CEO, we welcome you and the delegation that you have. I think the way we're going to start, Dr. Mnube, it's to start by way of introduction, so we know who is here from your side, to make it easy. We'll be happy if everyone can introduce themselves so we know the candidate appeal. And then we're also happy National Treasurer is here. The Auditor General's office is also here. Will introduce themselves. Then members of Parliament will introduce themselves. And then we can start the engagement. So I would hand over to you and your delegation to introduce yourself.
Thank you, Honorable Chair, and thank you, Honorable Members of this SCOPA. As a leader of ICASA delegation, I feel highly honored to come here and provide the objective verification of where ICASA was and where it is today. And in order to do this successfully, I told all my councillors to be here, and indeed they are all here. They will introduce themselves by name.
They may sit right behind you.
Yes,
I wasn't sure whether they are from the or...
They normally hide when they come here. They are afraid. But they can also...
Yes.
I see Councillor Sotikwa, I see Councillor Ndlovu, I see Councillor Kari. And I know that others who I commanded to come here had another engagement in Turkey, Councillor Lebowa and Councillor Baja, so they could not be with us today. I also have with me...
Let's deal with the introduction.
Yeah.
And let's allow everyone to introduce.
Yeah. Okay, sure.
And then we'll come back and start to deal with the subject.
Wonderful. So I will start here, you introduce yourself, and then we'll move ourselves to all.
After you've introduced yourself.
Yeah. My name is Steve Wanda. I'm wonderful indeed. I'm also the chairman of CENTEC. I was once the chairman of CENTEC, now I am the chairman of ICASA. Thank you.
All right. Good morning. My name is Pema Dlamini, the Chief Executive Officer for ICASA.
Morning. My name is Clarinda Simpson, the Chief Financial Officer for ICASA.
Morning. I'm Willie Curry, Councillor at ICASA.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Sam Vilagazi. I'm the Deputy Director General responsible for administration at the Department of Communications. Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Lebola Kaldaga. I'm from DOC Finance.
Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Rob Jennison. I chair the Audit Committee of ICASA.
Morning. My name is Nick Indro. I'm from ICASA.
Good morning, Maximilian Matavate, I'm the Corporate Secretary of Customs.
Morning, Chairman. My name is Marcia
Sutukwa, Accountant for Legal. Good morning, Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Pierson Lobuchi. I'm from the National Treasury.
And we have the mic switched off. Thank you. AG.
Morning, Chair, Honourable Members. My name is Gunay Magar.
Morning, Chair and Honourable Members. My name is Vikas Jan van Rensburg. I'm the Senior Manager responsible for the cost audit from the IGI.
All right. Singh?
Good morning, everybody. My name is Naren Singh, Member of SCOPE. Thank you.
morning. My name is Dion George, member of SCOPA.
Good morning. My name is Pierre Robbie. I'm a member of SCOPA.
Good morning. I'm Gertrude Pfeil, a member of committee.
Good morning. Ikon Fulis, a member of SCOPA.
Good morning. Roy Ainsley, member of SCOPA.
Good morning. Kapere Shilwan, member of SCOPA.
Thank you. I'm Comrade Temagudi. I share the comment. Now that we have someone from the department, maybe we could start there. We wrote to the Director General of the department. We also wrote to the minister. We have not received a response from the minister. We have been told the DG is not coming, but without any explanation. Is there any light that you might possibly shed on these two aspects before we go into substantive issues?
Thank you, sir. I think on the minister has indicated, I think sometime yesterday, but she will be talking to the chair about attendance, and with the EG, I am not aware of the reason for not coming, but I believe that there's an apology that she has sent to the minister.
Now that apology should have come to us. Well, we received it, but like I was indicating, there were no reasons. All right.
Thank you, Chairperson. Sorry, I'm a backbender today. Chairperson, I was in another committee a few weeks ago where the department was going to make a presentation to us on the budget. And we had a similar circumstance there where the Director General was not present of the department. Now here, there's funds that get transferred to ICASA from within the department, and I believe it's important for the department to be represented in some form or other so that they can answer particular questions that we may pose to them. Now, for how long communication is not going to have a Director General and parliamentary committees are going to come. In fact, on that occasion, we sent them away. We had to, because fruitless and wasteful expenditure where aid official had to fly back to wherever they came from because we had received no credible response from either the minister or the Director General on what was happening. And this is not an acceptable state of affairs, Chairperson.
Yeah, no, that's fine. There is a DG, there's somebody from finance. I think if the minister was here, we would have a meaningful engagement on that aspect. But in her absence, you have a DDG who, I suppose, cannot talk to the whereabouts of his DG. Dr. George?
Thank you, Chairperson. Most of this matter has already been covered, i.e. that the minister is not here and neither is the DG. And against that, I said against that, it is not an isolated incident regarding this, well, clearly this department in its work with SCOPA, with Parliament and other departments as well. So my question is quite simply, so what? You know, so we're not happy that the minister is not here, we're not happy that the DG is not here. But it's not my phone, I can assure you, but it is off.
Maybe before you proceed, because I forgot to mention, may you please switch off our cellular phone so that new information this side. This side, all know. Even if it's silent, it's not good enough, because when it does what was happening now, the recording is affected. In fact, there's no recording taking place for as long as your phone is ringing without vibration or silence. So please, let's switch our cellular phones off so that our purposes here can be at an appropriate level. Just finish off, Dr. George.
Yes, as I was saying, that clearly the minister isn't here, the DG isn't here, and, you know, we're clearly not happy about it, and then, of course, nothing happens. So I think the question had to be, a person, what are we going to do about it? I know perhaps this is a discussion that we want to have again in another session or whatever, but it really is not good enough, and we can't just keep saying we're not happy about it, because it'll never change things. There has to be some kind of action and subsequent consequence. Thank you, Chair.
All right, Dr. Rabi.
Chairman, I couldn't agree with my colleague more. Chairman, I mean, we should insist that the DG and the Honourable Minister that they hear, because with due respect, Chairman, this will carry on and on and on. We'll have to ask these people to appear in front of the committee. And we become the laughing stock if we carry on like we do at the moment, Chairman.
All right. I think, like Dr. George indicated, maybe let's talk to this at some other forum outside here. I'm sure that we are not ignorant of the issues around that department, whether it be in relation to the DG and everything else around it. Not that it justifies, I'm just saying, we do have a sense that all might not be well. And we'll certainly be communicating this from my side before we even discuss it, our displeasure, because I received no phone call from the minister or an email. I was checking to me. There's been no communication whatsoever. So I would want us to carry on that note. And I hope the DDG will also carry the sentiment. We're putting the budget of Parliament today, and I'm sure Singh will raise the question, what is Parliament? Who is Parliament? If we call officials and ministers and people don't even bother to respond, what's the value? What are we doing? Are we just going through the motions? Or is there anything substantive that we're doing? I think it brings that into sharp focus. But however, Mr. Chairman, we last had an engagement with the CASA, I think, in 2010, I think. And at that time, it was a happy engagement, so to speak, relatively. Because the entity had an unqualified audit, of course, with issues. And we had hoped that our engagement was supposed to assist in consolidating the momentum forward so that we don't have a Leninist one step forward, two steps back. And it appears that's exactly what happened. In terms of the odd outcome, something that we clearly and always are very unhappy about. We want to see continuous progress until the entity is also part of those that have been audited, and we can then focus on the most important element of value for money, because now we're nearly talking compliance. Do we comply with regulations, with laws? But we are not saying, do we have value for money? Out of all this compliance. So we are impeded from looking into that element because we still have these regulatory issues that, or let me say regulatory audit issues that keep on cropping up. So I think we would want to talk to these issues and say from your side, as the council, as the management, and as the CEO. What is it that that has gone wrong? What is going wrong? We have our finger on the pulse. What is it? So that when we report to Parliament, we could also make informed recommendations in terms of what we think might need to be done to ensure that the entity moves in the right direction. No doubt, ICASA is a very important strategic entity for the country. Its health and well-being is certainly one of our key concerns. And in that context, therefore, that we want to have this engagement. What we do not have in my supply chain is time. So we would want sharp, pointed questions that would assist. I'm sure we want to have an early morning today. Like I said, we are debating Parliament budget, so we don't want to miss that for any reason whatsoever, including ICASA. So the sooner we're done, the better. But I'll hand over to Dr. George to get us going. Dr. George?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm sure you do remember that all our questions always are very sharp and pointed, so we'll just carry on with that theme, but we'll be brief. I just want to refer to page number 33 and 109 because I'm reading them together. My colleague is going to be talking about non-compliance with laws and regulations, so I'm not going to be digging into that. But on page 33 and then also on 109, which I'll talk to, there are a number of compliance issues regarding closed litigation matters. And there's one particular under 7.5.2 regarding an ex-employee of ICASA on debt collection. It's not a big amount. But this person left the department and didn't, or the entity, and did not return their laptop. And then now there's this legal case that's going on, and I don't know what it's costing, etc. I don't really want to know that. But what I do want to know is, why is it so? Because surely there should be some kind of procedure in place when somebody leaves the department, and if they owe a laptop, that there's a process to get the laptop back, or there's some kind of deduction, and then you don't have to go through this painful process. That's the first part of the question.
Yes, sir. We'll respond to each question instead of taking a number of questions. What is the problem? This employee left with a laptop, but it's like becoming a hot battle. Page 33.
It was on page 33, under 752, the second case. The first one is not Noggle, and the next one is a car versus ex-employee debt collection.
Can we have a response? Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. Just below the paragraph, we have indicated the progress in as far as the issue is concerned.
That's not my question. My question is, I can read too. And I know there's progress, and it's 10,264 for this laptop. But there is a lots of legal stuff going on here. And my question is this. If I'm an employee, I have a laptop. When I leave, I don't give it back. The reason I didn't give it back is because I got away with not giving it back. So is there not procedural policy in place at ICASA? Because there must be other people with laptops. That is, when you leave, we collect the laptop back and we do it like this. you don't get your final salary until you give the laptop or something. That is my question.
Sure, can I respond? Yeah. Yes, indeed. I think also we do have the procedure that the member is referring to. Before a employee leaves the service of ICASA, we follow a process where we do the notice.
That's fine, but then what happened in this case? Why do we have this if we have that policy in place? I think that's where it's getting to.
Yeah. Chair, if I may assist, I believe the employee, the relevant employee was one of the regional staff members who was out of town during his last month of service. So I believe to some extent it might have fallen through the cracks where his last day of employment was up, not at head office or one of the regional offices, but away from the office. So the relevant checks and balances might not have been complied with.
Actually, they were not complied with.
Yeah.
Dr. Roach?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I understand that the procedure that is in place clearly didn't work or wasn't complied with. Thank you. And then that brings me to page 109. We're talking about contingent liabilities for various legal cases. Now, obviously, the year end has come and gone, etc., but there was an amount set aside for legal cases. Now, there seem to be quite a number of them, and that, I suppose, is in the normal scheme of business. But I want to know whether, now, if we're looking at how this fight on this over this laptop must have, I don't know how much cost, but clearly it's quite a bit out of hand, considering how much lawyers cost, etc., this 1.3 million rand contingent liability, was that sufficient?
If I may assist, the cases detailed in Note 26 are more contingent liabilities where ICASA estimates what they would need to basically pay out in the event the employee wins the court case. So it is not actually lawyer's fee as such, it's more what ICASA would lose in the event an employee is successful. So to date, the only case in point that has been settled is 26E, Lincoln Goliath versus ICASA, where the employee was successful and we had to basically pay out an amount of about 700,000 compensating. So with the other two cases, 26A and B, it's still matters in process that have not been concluded as yet.
Thanks, Chairperson. Then I want to look at page 46 to 59. Now, I'm not going to go into the detail. I'm sure my colleague might as well. But I just want to refer to the achievement of KPIs. Now, there's an entire string of KPIs that go over from page 46 all the way up to 59. And many of them, in fact, the majority of them, over 50%, are not achieved. Now, I don't know, 56. Now, I don't want to go into the detail of each one, because I'm sure it will come up a bit later, but I'd just like to get some kind of general indication of why that is so, because, I mean, there was a number of objects set, and they were not achieved.
Thank you, Chair. Just to give an overview, is that some of the non-achievements are either related externally or internally, and externally would be those cases whereby an achievement is subject to either ministerial policy directive. That's number one. And then we also have non-achievements that are internally related. In those cases, there may be issues pertaining to procurement of certain services, and as a result of not procuring the services on time, that has led to the non-achievement. But that is just a general response to the question.
Thank you very much. I then want to refer to page number 96, which talks about remuneration and bonuses, etc. Now, it seems to me, on page 96, okay, there's several people that have left the department, and so the thing is probably prorated in some way, but it looks like a number of bonuses were paid. Now, if I look at the fact that 36% of the victims are not met, and then bonuses are paid to various executives, etc. It doesn't seem to square to me that how can that be when the majority of the objectives are not met, but yet bonuses are paid? And I would particularly refer, and it will be another question going forward, but the one GM compliance risk and audit where bonuses also paid, yet to see the outcome of this audit. So I'm just wondering, how is it, is there a disconnection, or am I missing something in the payment of bonuses when objectives are not met?
The observation, Chair and honourable members, is correct. We had a legacy issue in as far as the performance bonus policy is concerned. What has happened at that particular time, you had an old policy of, I think, 2003, and that policy did not necessarily make provision that clearly stipulated that a clean audit, if we don't have a clean audit, there will not be performance bonuses. So there was a policy a gap in as far as that is concerned. But going forward, we have a new performance management policy.
This money was paid in a, within a positive vacuum.
That's correct.
Thank you, Chairperson. I hear also somewhere about something changing, and obviously that needs to be corrected. On page, I note that the chairperson of the board committee is here, which is a good thing. On page number 63, on internal audit and effectiveness of internal controls, there's a sentence that says, the committee is not satisfied with the effectiveness of the internal audit function, which has actually been outsourced, as far as I can see from the statement, and with management commitment to address all associated shortcomings. Now, that's quite a very heavily worded statement. It basically says, you know, this committee thinks it's not effective. What, you know, the internal audit is not actually testing what it should be testing and finding these problems. And when they are being raised, perhaps management doesn't seem to be particularly committed to getting them resolved. So I'd like to know from the chairperson, you know, what is the background to that statement?
Thank you, Chair. In response to that question, can I give it a bit of context? The audit committee comprises currently of members who were all appointed after the 1st of January 2012. So it's a fairly new audit committee. There were two audit committee members who remained from the old audit committee, one of whom resigned and one of whom unfortunately passed away. So there's entirely new audit committee members from the 1st of Jan 2012. Having said that, the audit committee in their meeting up until the time this report was signed for inclusion in the annual report was dissatisfied with the functions of internal audit within ICASA. And it led to a report to Council in October 2012, which Council actually endorsed in November 2012, where we believed that the internal audit function, and in particular the Chief Audit Executive, was not fulfilling her function properly. We weren't getting meaningful reports. In fact, we weren't getting intelligible reports tabled to audit committees. And we said we cannot have this Chief Audit Executive reporting to us any longer. Council agreed, and there was a suggestion that the internal audit function be outsourced. I think you made a statement that it has been outsourced, but it hasn't been outsourced. But there was a suggestion from the audit committee that the internal audit function be outsourced to make it effective. I trust that adequately responded to your question.
Yes, thank you.
And we hope it's not outsourced. See if I can respond. The recommendation from the audit committee was to outsource it, because in the audit committee's opinion, outsourcing was the most optimal way of doing things. Having said that, there was, in the request for proposal, the existing employees of internal audit were to be assumed by whoever the function was outsourced to. But that was, it's not a decision the audit committee can take, Chair. That was the recommendation from the audit committee.
I know, I was saying that for the ears of the chairperson of the council, we're not impressed with the unnecessary outsourcing. I mean, if you employ an incompetent person to head your internal audit, those are the kind of results we're going to get. But that does not say that there are no competent people. There are many entities and departments that have not outsourced, that have employed competent people. That's the issue. Dr. George.
Thank you, Chairperson. Given that the performance of the person that was doing the job, or the chief audit, if something was or something, where is this person? Is the person still employed now with the CASA, or have they moved on?
Thank you, Chair and honourable members. The person has moved on.
Thank you. I've just got two...
What happened?
Honourable Chair and members, the former chief audit executive was provided with several options before her employment was terminated, and failing to accept those several options, we were compelled to terminate her, you know, her employment based on the recommendation of the ARC.
Considering, Chairperson, that you raised this matter, we heard before, I think in the public Department of Public Works, where the CFO or somebody was not working very well, and then they didn't make the necessary action and then gave them options and then went to work somewhere else, apparently. And it's not necessarily a good idea for the public service. So these options that were offered, I mean, clearly the Chairperson of the Audit Committee is saying that the person doing the job was not doing it effectively. I think you concede the same thing. So if somebody's not doing their job effectively in the entity, then I'm sure you wouldn't want to have them go somewhere else and be equally not functional. So that action does need to be taken. And I'm a bit worried about some of the HR policies that are not in place or not, in. So can you make just detail exactly about that? So clearly the person wasn't doing the job. They were a highly paid individual. But somebody had a conversation with them and said, what are you talking about, these options? Why were not disciplinary action taken for inability to do the job or something like that? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair and honourable members. Just to paint the picture, the former chief audit executive, her performance was assessed by the audit and risk committee as articulated by the chairperson. And based on the outcome of that assessment, then there was a decision taken to remove her from the current position. Subsequent to that, to avoid the labor relation issue, we then looked at possible options where we can utilize the skills of a particular individual. So we had several options to either let her work in the compliance risk unit, and she refused. And then the only option was to look at a settlement of 3 months, which she also refused. So based on that, the service was completely terminated.
Thank you. I'm just thinking about how this thing just appears to be a disconnection. Somebody doesn't hand their laptop in, it's 10,000 rand. Now it's a lot of money, 10,000 rand. But then the person's earning a very high salary and is clearly not adding value and costing much more. So the disproportionate response, perhaps, I don't know. So do you have this situation where you're a senior employee in the public service and it's so difficult to do anything about your bad performance or whatever, there has to be this other thing. But if you are further down the hierarchy or closer to the rock-based service delivery and you maybe have less access to resources, then you are treated differently. And I think that's something that maybe perhaps Chairperson for us to consider as a committee, because the theme keeps coming over and over again. But anyway, thank you for the answer. I have two further questions to the Chairperson of the Audit Committee. Firstly, is that on page 64, the evaluation of the annual financial statement, there's a list of things that are evaluated. Did you evaluate the remuneration of directors and bonuses?
Chair, in response to the honourable member's question, we didn't. When you say evaluate, we certainly didn't evaluate in terms of are they being appropriately paid or whatever. It was we were given assurances by the different assurance providers that the disclosure as such was correct. But I'm not too sure what is meant by evaluate.
I'm saying, did the committee say, okay, we have got these people, and they're being paid in a particular way, maybe it's benchmarked elsewhere, but given that all of the objectives are not getting achieved, that maybe there needs to be a question as to are the bonuses are getting paid. Because I think that is what audit committees do look at as well.
Chair, in answer to the Honourable Member's question, no, that was not done by the audit committee. Having said that, I attended a parliamentary portfolio committee session where that same question was raised. And what the audit committee has done is we've asked for responses from management to why those were paid in prior years. But at this time, the answer is no, it was not done.
Okay, thank you. In future years, I'm sure we look forward to that question being asked because it's a very important one. And then finally, there is a statement just about Auditor General's report that says, after the financial year end, the committee was finished with a plan by management to address the audit qualification in order to avert such qualification in subsequent years. Now, if we look at the last couple of years, there was 1 year when there was no, that was not qualified. But in the past few years, they've been qualified. Now, I'm just thinking, given all of these objectives that were made, etc., and the depth of the difficulty given that you're not happy with the internal audit function, why will the future actually be different, given that a year has already passed now since this report? How satisfied are you that there is, in fact, improvement going on?
Again, thank you for the question. Through you, Chair, Honourable Member. The major qualification, when I say the major qualification, all qualifications are major, but it's pertaining to debtors, and the debtors reconciliation between Spectrum and JDE, as well as the licensing regulations. And the change in the licensing regulations is quite an onerous task, because you can't just change a law at whim. The audit committee engage with management to give their suggestions with council in terms of how the license fee regulation should be done. Because if I can speak quite frankly, I think the statute was actually quite unclear in terms of license fees. It was left to the licensee almost to determine how much they were going to pay. And if you had deviant licensees or licensees who were taking a bit of chance, they were able to do it because it wasn't based on audited figures. It was based on gross profit, and gross profit can be determined in different ways. Having said that, the license fees and the regulations have not been changed, and that's going to come in. Having said that, we've got a problem with prior year balances, because although if you can fix current year, you've still got problems with prior year balances. I can't speak on behalf of the Auditor General in terms of what type of opinion they're going to give, but I would suspect that there would be another qualification for that March 2013 financial statement.
Thank you very much. I thought of the same. But we'll see when the time comes. Thank you very much. I now want to go to page 65, and actually chairperson of the audit committee actually touched on the matter anyway, is the National Revenue Fund receivables and the National Revenue Fund payable. It's on page 65. And that also is together with page 73, which makes reference to these line items in the financial statements. Now, the first part of this question is, well, clearly, the Auditor General was unable to, you know, make an opinion on this, it seems, because it wasn't really clear. These amounts are not properly accounted for, etc. And then I notice also on page 73, record 65, that the amount of, well, there's a substantial difference in the amounts that are recorded there. I want to know why that is the case. Do you not know, firstly, do you not know what should be paid? And then also, why do you not properly account for it? Because that's the most important function, I think. I think the CFO needs to tell us that. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. The difference between the receivable and payable, I believe that was the question, the 792 million versus the 801 million under the payable. The difference is due to cash in the bank. ICASA can or is obligated to transfer money received from debtors or collected from debtors to Department of Communications at least within 30 days. So the 30 days gives us an opportunity to generate interest, because we are only funded by government grants or government allocation, and then we supplement that income with interest we generate on surplus funds that are sitting in the bank. So that's the difference between the receivable and the payable. And then the next question was why can't we account? As mentioned by the chair of the Audit Committee, in my opinion, it's not a matter of not being able to account correctly. We've got we were qualified on three areas. One being the spectrum revenue, the spectrum debtors. Two systems are being used currently. One we call the spectrum system to account and manage our debtors. All the data that's sitting on our spectrum system is fairly accurate and it's complete. And then we use the JDE financial reporting system to report or to generate a trial balance, general ledger, and such. So currently, because the two systems are not interfaced, meaning there's no real-time transfer of data between the two systems, what ICASA was doing was actually uploading, making use of service providers to, on a monthly or annual basis, upload data from the spectrum system to the JDE system. And when that was done, it was done incorrectly in that invoices were uploaded and receipts, and in most cases duplicated when they were uploaded, and to some extent the receipts were not matched correctly against the open invoices. So that led to incorrect data sitting on our JDE system. This happened about 3 or 4 years ago, and over the years the service providers we got on board were unable to rectify the errors or the overstated amounts sitting on JDE. So that is the one area that we will qualify on. So the spectrum system is very able to accurately calculate and generate invoices related to the spectrum license fee. So that is not a problem. It's more the transfer of the data between the two systems. But currently, we are in the process of developing an interface that can solve our problems in that area.
You're still in the process of developing what you've been developing.
Yes, we in the process of developing one. It should be completed by the end of this month, and we will be able to test to see whether it's functioning correctly. And by the time the Auditor General issues his opinion in July, we're hoping that the AG will indicate that our figures as reported in the current year's financial statements are appropriately reflected. Then we can proceed with the automatic transfer of data between the two systems. Until the AG gives us the go-ahead, it wouldn't be advisable to start transferring data between the two systems because it will just compound problems on our financial reporting system. So we are waiting for that opinion in July. And then the other area or aspects that we will qualify on, as mentioned by the Chair of the Audit Committee, is the what I call the flawed general license fee regulations. The Auditor General qualified us for accuracy of our license fees generated from our telecom debtors because of the fact that, as indicated, licensees had the option to basically calculate and determine what their revenue or license fee should be. And
where did that come from? Did that come from the regulations or from the Act itself?
It came from the general license fee regulation itself. The regulation in itself is ambiguous. It's subject to interpretation.
Yeah.
So
that's where the problem is, when the political leadership is not here. Because we need to understand the rationality of that seemingly deliberate vague position that actually prejudices the entity. But anyway.
Chairperson, perhaps another part to that question that you've raised about the political leadership is that has this matter been raised with the minister to say, look, I am unable to do this effectively because it isn't clear? Is somebody working on that at least then?
Chair, if I may, we've had numerous consultations with the Department of Communications. Also, it was mentioned in detail to the minister about the bilateral. And also with National Treasury, we've got a representative from National Treasury here as well. But yeah, we have been discussing together with the AG, also with the technical department at the AG, and yeah.
So where's the problem? Where are we now?
Well, now we've compiled a new regulation. It has been published in April. The basis is now different. It's revenue that we are using the basis to calculate. After consulting with AG, with the audit committee and various stakeholders, we believe that the revenue is a more verifiable basis. We've also got input from the industry as well in the public hearings that were conducted. And revenue is easier to calculate and to verify. And at the same time, included in the regulations, we've made it a requirement that the licensees actually issue a consult with an agreed-upon procedure order certificate.
Who does the regulation? Is it ICASA or the minister?
ICASA.
Oh, so it was the leadership of ICASA that in order to serve the interests of business, crafted regulations that were just by the way. Okay, so it has nothing to do with the political leadership, it has to do with ICASA itself. Alright, that's fine.
Thank you, Chairperson. I then just want to dig into a bit about this interest. Then on page 99, that was in fact my next question, but you touched on it already as to where this would come from. So we know that there's money lying in the bank account. For 30 days it rolls, and then obviously interest gets paid on it. And is that then the interest on page 99 under 10 that I'm reading there, because it was quite a big increase? Is that the interest? Is that where it was sourced?
Chair, the interest on page 99 of 10 is actually interest that was paid to receive our revenue and also interest calculated on a finance lease. So it's not actually interest generated from money sitting in the bank. The interest generated from our surplus funds in the bank is sitting on page 93, note number 4. You'll see there the notice headed revenue from exchange transactions. Interest income is $4.4 million. So that's the interest that is generated from funds sitting in the bank.
Okay, thank you. That's very clear to me. So why is it falling then in page 93? Because one wouldn't expect to do that. Because if you look on page... these unidentified, actually maybe that would be the case then. I've just lost the page. It was, there's a page, yes, 107, where, note 21, on page 107, unidentifiable receipts. Now that's gone up quite substantially. So there's two parts to my question here. Your interest is falling, okay, and I get it that you've got money in bank, and you're getting interest on it, but the interest is falling, but the money that's not identified, if I understand correctly, you don't know where this money came from, unidentifiable receipts. Did somebody pay you, but you don't know where it is sourced, and therefore it would be lying in the bank? And if so, you'd be getting more interest on it. Or am I missing something?
Chair, if I may explain, note 21, unidentifiable receipts, other payables, that amount, the $81 million, that is also the result of the upload errors. So that amount cannot be relied on. What's sitting in there is unmatched receipts and that have not been allocated against invoices raised for debtors. The amount of unidentified receipts, meaning receipts where we don't know which licensee has basically paid the carter, the extent is $600,000. So the balance is errors that we cannot justify. So, yeah. And if you look at note 4 on page 93, the interest income is actually decreasing because of the interest rate. And it also depends, how much we have in the bank at that point in time, but we've got no control over that. It's subject to fluctuating interest rates.
Sure. Thank you very much. Now, obviously, I mean, I got these statements a couple of days ago. I read them on the aeroplane twice, and it was not difficult to see that there's something wrong here. You know, the numbers are going the wrong way. Now, an 81 million is quite a big number. You know what I mean? So I'm just thinking that here is a problem. It's big. An MP can see it is big. In the entity, is somebody, I mean, obviously we ask the questions and you tell us, but I mean, in my head, this is like a major problem, because if you've got such a big variance in your system because of an error in an upload, you know, surely there will be some progress, and yes, you report upon it, and the auditor general says, well, actually, I don't know, this is not here to me. So, and with such a large number going through that account, the opportunity for leakage is very substantial, I think. So from a risk management perspective, I think it's horrible, actually. So maybe CFO, maybe chairperson of the audit committee, also supposed to be risk committee, can tell us, you know, what are you doing to manage that risk other than, well, you know, we're working on the problem. You know, surely that's not close enough.
Chair, if I may go first. We are working on the problem, okay? As I've indicated earlier, we've got service providers on board assisting us. We have completed the 12-13 financial statements where we were able to correctly reflect what the debtor balances should be. So at this point in time, we rely on the spectrum management system, because whatever data is currently on that system is the correct data. So we've been able to basically reverse 3 or 4 years of data going back to inception of the errors, and we've managed to reload on the JDE financial reporting system to balance back to what's sitting on the spectrum system, which is the more reliable. Yeah, it has the correct information, if you want to call it that. Yeah. So currently,
it can either be correct or not correct. It cannot be a matter of choice whether you want to call it correct or not.
It is the victim data. It generates the system generates the transactions. It calculates the invoice amounts. It generates invoices. So that is the correct.
I just wanted to say with confidence that it's correct.
Yes.
Not say it in a way that suggests well, there can be room for errors as well. No way. Wouldn't believe it ourselves as well.
As far as I'm concerned, it's correct, but our external auditors await for their audit confirmation of that. So we have taken that data and been able to reload it back onto to JDE to correct all these unaccounted for balances, including the 81 million. So if you look at the 12-13 financial statement, there is a very material prior year adjustment to the extent of about 400 million. Where we've been able to correct the prior year errors that we could not account for.
Because I think that was the challenge, the transfer of information from the spectrum to the JDE. All right, Mr. George?
Thank you, Chairperson. I must say, I'm not feeling very confident, but hopefully in the future we'll see that it all gets sorted out and everybody is happy and it's all well. Then on page number, just for clarity for my own sake, there is on page 95 is payments to the council. Now, I'm not sure about the council. I didn't look into big detail on that. It's a million rand that is paid. Is this is like a full-time job, or is it paid for a couple of meetings, or, you know, what actually is this money for? So how much time here? So are we paying, is it a certain random amount for a meeting, or are the councillors permanently residing in the offices, or how does this actually work?
Thank you, Chair and honourable members. The councillors are full-time executive councillors.
Okay, all right.
Thank you. And I think that I can fold for now and hand over to my colleague. Thanks, Chair.
All right. Thank you, Dr. George. Push. Yeah, no, just note it.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think my colleague has exhausted nearly everything. He was able to
dissect and go into details in every area. Mine is just to follow up, Chair. There might not be major new questions. The area that, of course, I was supposed to limit myself to is compliance with laws and regulations, Chair. But I wanted to start with just a statement about that, achievement of planned targets. Chair, there is an emphasis there of spending. And throughout the whole document, you hear the council speaking about insufficient resources to enable them to do 1, 2, 3. But in this particular area, spot on, the clear understanding on major programs of the council. I would want to hear from them as to what leads to that particular area of understanding on major responsibility of the council. Chair, just to remind you, markets and competition, engineering and technology, consumer access, they are key in my own, even the Act itself, it's clearly saying that. How do we then say we are under resourced while we are unable, to utilize what we are having?
Yes. Why they understand?
Chairperson and honourable members, can I just get clarity? I'm referring to on page 67 under achievement of plan targets. Honourable Chair and members, I tried to explain earlier on that when you look at the overall targets that were set and not achieved and achieved, there were specific ones whereby we say this was either related to a policy directive. And then the ones that were related to internal issues would either be a pending problem within the organization.
No, that's fine. I think, what we need to do, let's talk about markets and competition. Was it caused by internal failures or by external constraints, and what were these? So that we're able to deal with a specific issues as highlighted in the report.
Thank you, Chair. Perhaps maybe if I can suggest that we the performance tables, which is under starting from I think it's page 46. Members will notice the...
On which page?
Starting from page 46, that whole section on the performance or predetermined objectives.
Yeah.
I think what we have done is that the different strategic objectives on the left-hand side of the particular table will talk to a specific objective. And if you look to, at the one that is affecting markets and competition in particular, we can look at the ensure the provision of broadband services, for example. That is on page 47.
Yeah. What number is it?
We can look at strategic objective 2.1, 2.2, and 2.3, for example, which is directly linked to markets and competition. The unit itself. And then that the last row, which is indicating the achievement and progress during the financial year, there is a note explaining the reasons for non-achieve. I'm not sure if that is a sufficient answer.
I think accounting authority is changing and, you know, guessing, because the area that it is referring to, strategic objective 2.1, 2.2, I don't think that talking to the marketing, the ones that you specifically said, talk to that, are not, you know, one way or another related to. It's about the regulatory strategy for the broadband. And that you, the question that we were talking about is it the one that understands it on markets and competition. How do you, unless I'm completely out of contact with the, you know, the document itself.
If I can just provide clarity on the the performance information. If we look at the section that specifically relates to ensure the provision of broadband services, on your extreme right of that particular table, the strategic objective 2.1, 2.2, 2.3 is the responsibility of market and competition. So when you respond in targets not achieved, it's related to market and competition as a program that has indicated that these are these targeted, you know, deliverables, and this is what we intend to achieve over the financial year. So if we look at that one, that is just one part that is affecting market and competition. But if we move to the next section, again, one will notice that there are some of the strategic objectives.
No, that's fine to you. Okay. Let's take those three that you've identified. If you look at 2.1, the reason it was not achieved had to do with the, there were concerns around data integrity and storage. So that would be internal. The second one, speaks about no progress on white paper. So clearly that should be from the ministry side. But concerns about data integrity and storage, what was that? Why did those concerns arise? And where are we now in relation to that? Because it means, because there was concerns around this, you're not able to rule it out. And that's the under explanation. But why then were there issues around data integrity and storage?
Thank you, Chair. I think if we look at the issue around data integrity, at that time the respective program wasn't able to come up with anything concrete. So there was a reason for that particular activity to be postponed to the current year.
All right. You want to make an addition to it?
Mr. Chairman, the purpose of this objective was to try and look at the supply side elements with regard to building broadband. Now, the supply side elements are all related to the current networks, particularly the large networks of Telkom, Neotel, the mobile operators, the large internet service providers. And having put this as a strategic objective into the plan, the Markets and Competition Division then found that, in fact, there wasn't enough data on the state of these networks to construct a proper supply-side broadband plan from the regulator's point of view. So what this then led to was a whole process of engagement with the major network providers, the electronic communication network services, to get them to provide that, that information. And the whole process has from that point continued and evolved into trying to now have a project which is looking at what we're calling the broadband value chain. All the link between international connectivity through the national networks down to the last mile. So while it's true this particular project was not achieved, we learned something from engaging with it and from engaging with the network suppliers. Part of the problem, I think, with the way that we structured this strategic plan was that many of these things are involved us in engaging with the broader sector So we're in a kind of dialectical relationship with our network operators. And if we don't get information from them, then it means that in the short term that objective was not met, but we learn from that.
I think I'm satisfied with the better explanation. The equipment, how do you keep on transferring money for ICASA while you are unable to create an enabling environment? I'm sure part of it is the one that I've just made mention of, the strategic objective number 2.2 and 2.6. They are solely, you know, resting on the department. What are the problems, DDD? Sure, I'm in charge. If I say DDD, don't look at the chairperson.
Thank you, Chair, honorable members. I think it's important to indicate to the committee that there are engagements that take place between ICASA and the ministry or the department from time to time on several issues. Some of the challenges that ICASA finds itself in, it's not things that are new, and it's not things that the minister has not expressed a view on them and even gave direction in terms of how this thing needs to be implemented, because I think the committee would appreciate the fact that it becomes one thing to give a direction on how to move, and the implementation then becomes another, especially if the other party seems not to be pulling the weight. So all these other issues, including the issues around qualifications, clean audits, and so on, have been repeatedly raised, and the minister has given guidance, in my view, which is sufficient to get the regulator going.
The issue relating to white paper. Well, what are you trying to say to us?
Honorable Chair, can I just to go back to the issue? I'll respond in a few minutes. I just need to go to the issue quickly, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, and then can we then go back to the page that spoke about the bonus? You were saying at the time you gave bonus out of a vacuum, there was no policy whatsoever. Just share with us what made you to arrive at giving these bonuses if there's no policy. Were you just wake up because it was your birthday, then there's money? Get this one, receive this one. What informed you? Because I'm keen to know, in the absence of a policy, what informed you?
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Member. The vacuum in the policy is the clause that makes reference to know if an organisation is not producing a clean audit, there will not be performance bonuses. So that is the vacuum within the policy. There was a policy of 2003, which was, you know, giving a blanket, you know, approval to say that irrespective of whether the organization has a clean audit or not, people would automatically qualify for a bonus. So I made reference to a new policy that has come into effect last year. Which
you are saying under your nose, you wouldn't mind. Despite that, you are sitting with the performance of the customer. You wouldn't mind just to say, this is time, now I must just give money because they're saying I must give. You would give, cautiously so.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Member. No, I don't think it was a question of just, you know, giving out money. I think one was constrained by the fact that I think we went through a number of deliberations between management and council to try to deal with the issue. And at that time, it was either agreeing or disagreeing. And
okay, let's look at GM Consumer Affairs and GM Engineering and Technology. By the way, we are from it. We were saying understanding. Now here you are giving bonus.
just make us to understand.
Thank you, Chair. I think the decision was not an easy decision. It was on a basis that on one hand you have a policy instrument that perhaps gave management as a whole the opportunity to claim a bonus. And at the same time, we had the challenge that...
I think what you want, what then becomes the basis of claiming the bonus? In terms of that existing policy, whatever it was, how was it crafted? What was the content that would make it possible for GM, Consumer Affairs, Engineering and Technology to claim a bonus of 34, and HR to get the 5,000 bonus?
Thank you, Chair. I think there was a performance management system which had its own problems at a particular point in time. And that management system actually had made provision that anyone who was...
Who was sitting in those units who was supposed to have been crafted a credible and, convincing police? Who was sitting at that particular unit, at that particular time?
Thank you, Chair. At a particular point in time, we had a general manager for HR who has, left about a year or so, and they were responsible for crafting the policy.
And in your own understanding, you were seeing everything in order. Because if that was not the case, you would have been saying the manager responsible who failed to have been, developing a policy that it's, universal and standard. We charge that particular person, and this is what we have done. So in your case, you have seen nothing wrong. Everything. I'm giving this example of saying, look at this person. He's giving people bonuses for understanding. To you, understanding is a good thing. You need that. Not even, sometimes people, they hide behind saving. They save for this. He clearly say understanding.
Thank you, Chair and Honourable Members. I think when I joined the organization in 2010, November, my introduction to the management was to not pay bonuses if there is not a qualified audit opinion. Unfortunately, I had to back my argument on a particular policy. I could not just make a pronouncement on that particular basis. And at that time, as I said, I was dealing with a policy that was old, that was not reviewed.
I think I remember well that there was one farm industrial election from the workers demanding bonuses because it is policy that by the end of the year they must get a bonus, whatever the case. Okay, no pillow hush.
Thank you, Mr. President. On page 100, exactly 100. Yeah, 100. You don't get 100 easily, Chair. It's a very important page. But this page, it's talking about...
Okay, 100 years, what you said. Or 100.
I like that, Chair. It made emphasis to fruitless, wasteful, and irregular expenditure. And I heard the CFO explaining that payment to SARS was on the basis of this and that. And I'm looking at relevance here. If you look at B, paragraph 1, 2, 3. Yeah. It says the amount was due to payment of tax to the incorrect account. Do you hear that, Chairperson? So how do you do this kind of things here for paying money into an incorrect account? Who knows? It might be my account.
Chair, if I may respond, this was also one of those legacy issues that took place about 2 or 3 years ago. Yes, indeed. The money was paid into an incorrect account, but subsequent to that, we've reinforced internal controls and ensured that data capturers, the work produced by data capturers or people inputting into the bank account transactions, that their work is always subjected to a second and a third review to ensure that this sort of thing doesn't happen again. And since this particular incident, which was a one-off, but still unfortunate.
It was for which financial year? Because trying to read that paragraph, I'm struggling to get the financial year.
It was around the 2011 financial year.
No, 2011, 2012.
2010-11. And we were charged a small portion of
I'm just saying, I hope you are looking at that report. I'm saying what the numbers that are written there in terms of financial years don't make sense.
No. Can I explain the years reflected? It's not years, yeah. It's actually months. So it talks about the payment, the past payments for the month of January in the 2011 year, and then month of August in the 2011 year. So, yeah, we pay tax over on a monthly basis. Yeah.
Okay.
The 2 months, therefore, falling into one financial year?
No. The 2011/01 falls within the March 2011 financial year, and then the August 2011 is the 11/12 financial year, ending March 2012.
Again, you go and read on interest charged on late payments and rentals of regional offices. But why are we have to pay money that we were not supposed to? Because should payments be effected in time, we wouldn't have been going this 3.6 figure. It was unnecessary. Who did that? What happened to this particular individual?
Chair, the procedure, Kikasa, is that the rental payments for the regional offices are authorized by the regional staff. So by the time the invoice reached the regional office, it was already a couple of days late, and then it was further delayed by the late sign-off by one of the staff members responsible for approving.
I get what I'm trying to say. Don't try to play cover-up. Be honest. This man was supposed to have been paid excluding 3.6. Should he have been paid in time? And then the payments of this renter, it wasn't for the first time. It's an office that we have been occupying it for some time. How did it happen that in a particular year, you're starting to see that you have to pay late in order to have interest in it? Are you saying it's justifiable?
Chair, no, it's not justifiable. It is fruitless and wasteful expenditure. We were given reasons as for the delay. Before I say anything further, I would prefer that the CEO speaks to whether action was taken against the staff member, because it's not within my control.
That's where you were supposed to have started from. Can we get it? What happened?
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. This particular wasteful expenditure, we had engaged the respective manager and tried to coop it from him.
Do you know the name of the person?
Thank you, Chair. It's the regional manager for regions. His name is Mark Ramsey.
It's part of your interest here today. Thank you. I'm sure we'll want to see the progress, leading to the conclusion of this, because we can't allow the accounting authority, a situation where people are failing to execute their functions, and then this, we have to pay money because of the failure, and we thought everything's normal. It cannot. So we need to see, you know, some tighter action in that regard. Maybe that goes with the procurement of services without following the necessary procedure. Why are this continuous non-compliance look like to be the order of the day in ICASA? People, they just, you know, despite that they know what the law is saying, they just give whoever they meet on the road. And these things, you know, perceptions that they are, you know, some element of fraud and then corruption within, you know, entities of state. How do you continuously non-comply with the law?
Thank you, Chair. I think with respect to the non-compliance with the PFMA, we have put certain, you know, sort of controls in terms of, for example, if there is a procurement of a service provider without necessarily going through the RFQ processes, it would then be flagged ahead of time by the supply chain.
But what happened here, can we talk to this, what happened in these cases, and what happened to the people who were involved? It creates a picture of anarchy, where before a process is certified by an existing body, the bid adjudication committee, somebody already appoints. Who is that person who was so brave enough, so brazen to do that? And what happened to that person or those people? Or what was it that was involved here?
Chief, I may respond to the procurement of the computers. What happened here was that the normal supply chain procedures was circumvented. The responsible official was the supply chain supervisor, and he was subsequently issued with a written warning.
Was the supervisor doing this? So.
I'm not sure you would know that it was for a tone of 417,000. Nearly half a million. Instead of, you know, getting an approval from the adjudicating committee, this person just pay. They're my friends. I'll meet them next door on my way home. Then we give a written warning. Isn't it a warning should be, you know, yeah, should commensurate with the, you know, the level of aggravation we are talking about. Half a million, we just say, hey, why not? We will see you next week. We don't want it.
I hope it was not a warning for 6 months, but if you do this within 6 months, we'll deal with after 6 months,
the proposal. Thank you, Chair and Honourable Member. I must just verify.
That's what you want.
The procurement of the computers, what has happened, and what this is part the CFO was trying to say, that there was already a decision being proposed.
No, we understand those things. Look at the last sentence of the Auditor General. That the appointment was done without it being certified by the bid adjudication committee. Unless if you're saying that BAC is optional, not important. That's where we're at. Not the other processes from behind. We're not questioning the necessity for the services to be procured or even the qualification of the service provider that was given the job or about compliance. Process it. And that is why you had to hide that guy or whoever it was a warning. And the question that is raising is that seeing that he was a supervisor, not somebody who would say, I need a step, was a warning appropriate sanction? Or is it just a slap on the wrist?
Well, Chair, we assess the situation, and at that time a written warning was sufficient to deal with the issue.
Okay, no, that's fine.
Sometimes we don't see these things with the same eyes.
Sure.
Because they are very classy, right now are apparently classy, you might not see big things that I'm seeing in the document. You still see small while I'm seeing big because of my spectacles. I'm sure that's what he said. Or to him this was just a minor. No, half a million is nothing. State will continue, you know, getting revenue collection from other, you know, sources and have more than half a million. I'm sure. It's an attitude that we cannot condone, and it should come to an end in any outer person. It then brings the question of leadership. Immediately it then talks to the leadership to say, the next question is, why do you then, you know, fail to put systems that you are making sure that on a monthly basis, reporting performance are, you know, taken on board? Because that's a major, you know, is now centered around the leadership, which you should have been showing that this kind of thing can happen, and you would have been detecting them quickly. Now, the fact that the quarterly reporting, you know, system is not in place, what do you call it?
Thank you, Chair. The manner in which we remedied the problem was to, on a monthly basis, the executive will sit and look at all matters pertaining to non-compliant, especially around supply chain. And at that stage, as and when there is something that will come up, we'll then act on it.
I can put it to you here that, by the way, you have not yet, you know, put sufficient and implement procedural systems that are supposed to have been in place to make sure that the predetermined objectives are easily, you know, detected. You haven't put that in place. How do you then, when you said monthly, you mean just writing whatever I wanted, because there's no guideline that you have, you know, put up in place yourself.
Chair, I thought I was responding to the issue of dealing with the bookless and wasteful expenditure.
They are related, these things. You can't have this one clean and have this one wrong. It should have been driven. Something is driving them all, you know, because there are no systems in place. And PMA is calling you to do that, to say put up systems that will enable you to, you know, to perform better. The fact that what I'm saying is not there, how do you then expect to have other things, you know, happen here? No way.
Chair, I think we have, after the presentation of the audit finding, we had put processes in place to deal with the performance of the organization in totality.
Maybe we should blame ourselves, Chairperson. We did not remind them that we are dealing with the past. The issue of, you will see us in the next quarter, they are good for portfolio committee. We are not a portfolio committee. We are dealing with exactly what you couldn't, you know, perform well. That's our area of operation. So today you might have learned out of that, then we wanted to know why you know less in that particular time. That's our area of operation, unfortunately. This other area, I'm sure, if honorable, you know, Kulana was here, he was going to smile and said, no, you are doing well. Not us. We are taking you on what have, you know, come and pass. Okay?
Yeah, all I can say is that we acknowledge the non-compliance in the year under review.
Let me say this energy. I don't want him to be exhausted beyond what I've seen. Thank you.
Honorable Six, you had to end up earlier, and just in time, yeah. Okay, to the thing, Dr. Rabi, and then back to KZ.
Thank you, Chairperson, colleagues. I have a few questions.
But firstly, I'd just like to reinforce what Honorable Tabajana said about lack of controls and lack of leadership. Because when you read this report of the Auditor General, I mean, that's common thread. Lack of controls, lack of leadership. And I note here, when we talk about leadership, it would include the council, because there's an arrangement here where the councillors have specific responsibilities, and where we find that reporting by general managers are to the councillors and not to the CEO, which I find rather strange, but I think it's permissible in terms of the Act here, which they quoted, Act Section 44, bracket A. But I would have thought that the person that we should be targeting in terms of answering the questions is the CEO of the organization. Now, just to confirm the lack of controls and leadership, I mean, one has to read what's written by the chairperson and chairman of the audit committee on page 64, right on the top. The quality of budget submitted in terms of the PFMA. The committee reports that budgets were not carefully and diligently considered by management in order to avoid large variances between actual and budgeted capital expenditure during the financial year. Now, that's a serious indictment coming from the audit committee. And we need to hear why that happened and what's happening as we move forward with this new arrangement of reporting to councillors. If you also look at other statements made by the Auditor General, you'll see on page 13 of a briefing that we received, and not on page 13 of the AR, ICASA did not have a dedicated employee or unit to manage strategic processes. They have appointed an individual with the office of the CEO to collect and monitor performance data against the target set in the strategic plan in November 2012. The AG goes on to say challenges regarding capacity and skills in the licensing environment remain a concern. Then again, another statement which I'm picking up, management has not implemented adequate controls over record management of predetermined objectives. That's to reinforce the lack of controls and lack of management. But the one positive thing that I've noticed here, Chairperson, is in terms of gender equity within the organization, staff complements, and if you see on one of the pages, it's almost 50% male and female, which is encouraging. You just need to fire one male and employ a female and you'll be 50-50, which is very, very good. 174-176. But Chairperson, I'd just like...
As long as that can lead to an qualified audit.
Yes. I think females will do a better job, but now with half and half, it doesn't seem that it's working very well. But see, I'd just like some response to this general malaise, which I would say, within the organization in terms of lack of controls and leadership, before I go on to my question which relates to staff. Thank you.
Can we talk to this issue that's been raised by Honorable Singh? Are we... Why is a perceived lack of solid management on issues? And where are we now in terms of dealing with all those issues?
Thank you, Chair. I'll turn to answer the question. The issue around budget and programs not able to honor what they opted to do, we acknowledge that there was a challenge or a problem in terms of planning and budgeting. And we had agreed that on every on a quarterly basis, the different programs will then present what programs they have made. And in the event that a particular deliverable had to be either postponed to the, or deferred to the next financial year, there will be a process that will be followed, and that particular process will lead to making a presentation to the council for a decision to be made on a deviation.
But this talks to basically to the quality of planning. and or the quality of implementation.
Thank you, Chair. I do acknowledge that yes, we do have a challenge in terms of planning in the organization. The minimal systems that we have tried to put together going forward will start addressing those type of problems. That's why we had a dedicated person looking at performance information.
Yes, Chairperson, just as a follow-up, the new arrangement from November 2012, and maybe the Chairperson can respond, I mean, is that having a positive impact on the organization in terms of management and governance?
Thank you, Honorable Singh. Yes, I can certainly say it has helped us to improve ICASA vastly. We are not there yet. But the processes that we have put in place, for instance, we now have a dashboard. And every council meeting, we look at where we are in our dashboard that is commensurate to the AG dashboard. And that's why I can safely say it's a pity my colleague, you know, from Leboa, who is keeping this dashboard, is not here today. But in his last report, we were close to 70% accomplishment in areas that we want to do. And you see, most of these things, as my colleague said earlier, these were legacy issues. But then a good leader, when you come to an organization, you don't say, I am only operating here and I don't take into account what happened in the past. We inherited ICASA with all its strengths and with all its weaknesses. It just so happened that the weakness overshadowed the strength. But I can safely say that in this new administration, we have made a tremendous move. If you look at the people who are sitting here, they are all new. And if you look at most of the people who are at the back, we're not with ICASA when these things happen.
All right.
So it took strong and bold leadership to bring this interregnum, to bring these changes.
Okay. No, that's fine, Chair. I hope next time ICASA comes, you will all still be here so we don't have new faces. Because this lack of continuity, you want to make an addition, sir?
Thank you, Chair. Just on this issue of leadership, if one looks at 2010, in the second half of 2010, we had four new councillors and a new CEO. And at the end of 2010, we commenced the strategic planning process, which is reflected here in the 2011-2012 report. And I think, quite frankly, that we were over-ambitious in setting a lot of these performance targets. And in that sense, we have been involved in a kind of iterative process of learning from this and trying to adjust as we move through them. So similarly, I think on the audit side, and particularly with regard to the finance function, the new CEO engaged quite strongly around with the then CFO during that year of the first part of 2011. Leading to CFO services contract not being renewed. And then by January 2012, we then had our new CFO in place. So in a way, these steps have been taken to try and improve the situation. But from a leadership perspective, we have to acknowledge that our strategic plan was too ambitious, and perhaps the steps taken to deal with the shortcomings in the finance department were too slow in this period under review.
Okay.
Chairperson, my second question relates to page 94, also related to staff and management. If you look at page 94, staff costs. And if you look there at particular items, performance awards from 6.5 million to 8.6 million, there's an item, periodic payments. Maybe they can tell us what periodic payments are. Almost 8 million RON. Then there's temporary staff, which has gone up threefold from 11 to 12, from 1.2 million to 3.9. And then leave expenses have come in here now from just 150,000 actual in 2011 to 2.8 million in 2012. I just have a response for that, and then I'll ask my final question related to another issue.
Secretary, the periodic payments amount relates to a federal policy that we have in place at ICASA, where ICASA contributes. And then the temporary staff, the big increase is mainly due to temporary staff being used in the finance division due to a lack of skills in the administered revenue section, and to a lesser extent, a temporary staff being utilized in the light departments. And then the lead expenses, that is the provision at the end of the year, is the number of leave days that are sitting unused at the end of the financial year that we provide for. So that depends on whether staff take leave or not.
Yes, Chip, I just want to follow up on the funeral policy. Are you killing them off there in the organization? If you take 350 staff, and you divide, because that's what you got, 350, 174 females and 176 males, according to page 28, I think. I mean, 7.8 million run in funeral, I mean, can't you get policies? Or?
Where's the funeral policy?
And the answer to periodic payments.
Oh.
Was funeral policy. Or funeral something.
Oh.
Now I'm just saying, killing them off and paying a lot of money. For 350 people, that's what, 20,000, or, if my math is correct? Or more each, when you can buy a policy much cheaper. I don't know what it means, funeral policy. If you can just explain that to me.
Currently, we contribute not just for staff members, but for family as well, immediate family. So the funeral policy payments, is included in that line item together with one or two other amounts. I can't remember what it might be. But the funeral policy comes to mind.
Can we be forwarded with details on that particular line, periodic payments, the breakdown on it, to the committee within a week or so?
Can we get it by next week, Tuesday? Tuesday, the 18th, we'll be back in office.
Chair, we don't see ICASA very often, so I'm going to ask another question here related to consumer protection, because it's in the annual report. One of the responsibilities there is consumer protection. Now, I just wanted to know, as ICASA is the authority responsible for granting these licenses and things like that, and the fees, has there been any indication of any collusion between mobile operators in terms of the fees they charge, and also our fixed line operator? And what can they say about these kinds of things as charges to the consumer up there? And then if you have to protect the consumers, I don't know if other colleagues have this problem as well, of dropped calls. I mean, there's forever dropped calls on a mobile phone. When I travel from the airport to home, at least 10 times the call drops. And then are these mobile operators held responsible for that? Because they charge you a fee. And what is the process been to make sure that they have enough of these masks all over to provide an adequate service to the citizens of the country and the users of these telephones? Thanks. Is it not their responsibility? I don't know.
Sorry, could I have clarity on the first part of the question? Then I think Councillor Sotigwa could deal with the quality of service. The issue of mobile termination rates is something that we have dealt with during this period, where we have set a glide path to reduce the wholesale termination rate from something like 126 cents per minute down to this current financial year, where it's down to 40 cents. And that has been done through a regulatory process with the operators. So in that sense, steps have been taken, and we're currently embarking on a new modeling process to
see if we can reduce that further. And you might have seen that we released a cost to communicate program last Friday, which we hope to have new further downward slide on the mobile termination rates by October, which will come into effect in March 2014. There's no evidence that there's formal collusion between any of the operators, but I'm sure that they are all watching each other. And from time to time, you will see, as most recently with Cell C, that they do engage in the form of price competition, but I think that most of the time they are watching each other's packages and cost mechanisms. In terms of drop call, I'll ask Councillor Sotikwa to respond to that.
Up on that, you see, while they are watching each other, the consumer's pocket is getting empty. I mean, we can afford Parliament pays our halls up to a point, but the ordinary consumer out there, and nowadays, you know, Chairperson, I was at a welfare pen the other day, and an elderly gentleman had to phone 0860 number, whatever it is, to inquire about his new Tata card. And he thought the call was free and used his cell phone. 201 rand or something cost him for one call, but he had to hold on. So now people, ordinary people out there, are really taking strain with the cost of these calls. And I read somewhere, I think, in the same article on your press release, that South Africa is 31 out of 34 in terms of costs of calls. Is it in Africa? In Africa. 31 out of 34 countries in Africa. Thanks to the Honourable Lindsay. So I just thought I'll make the point for them to appreciate, you know, the hardship that's been put on ordinary people and the role that they have as a CASA in that regard. But in really about the drug call as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Members. The issue of drug calls has been quite central in our work. Recently, we were asked by the Portfolio Committee on what sort of infrastructure do we need in place to manage quality of service. If you look at the kind of infrastructure, for example, sitting in an exemplary country such as Ukraine, we are completely under-investing in the infrastructure required to monitor quality of service. And we prepared a memo that we will share with members of the Portfolio Committee and National Treasury to motivate the kind of budget that we need to set up the equipment. And at a policy level, Minister may need to decide on whether this should really be sitting within ICASA or this should be sitting in a coalition of institutions that monitor quality of service. And I say so because if you look at the Ukraine example, the mobile operators, the fixed line operators have to contribute a certain amount of funds towards the setting up of the infrastructure required to ensure quality of service monitoring. So there are different models, but it requires extensive investment. Needless to say that in spite of the limitations of investment, we have, as ICASA, field workers who daily go and do quality of service monitoring. We've published reports on our website. We acknowledge it's not sufficient. More could be done, certainly with more capacity pertaining to this particular function. I just want to indicate at the policy level, you know, different decisions have various ways of addressing this. In Nigeria, very recently the regulator withheld the ability of, for example, MTN to continue with promotions until it could demonstrate to the citizens of Nigeria that it had upped its commitment towards a better quality of service. So the tool, the legislative tool, very strong in Nigeria, and maybe an amendment is required in our legislation to enable us to do that sort of thing. Thank you, Honourable Member.
Yes, Dr. Abi.
Thank you, Chairman. Some of my questions have been partially covered by the Honourable Singh. But Chairman, on page 94 of I'm referring to item 6 there, overtime pay was something like 1.68 million, 157, and then temporary staff was almost 1 million. And, Chairman, I want to ask the chief financial officer here. Your annual financial statements did not comply with...
Who came late with a question that Bella phone should be switched off.
Sorry? Mine is off, Chair. I don't know who it is. But to come back to it, I mean, the annual financial statements did not comply with Section 40 of the PFMA. My question to the Chief Financial Officer is, what proactive steps have you done to... Clearly there must be capacity problems within your financial department. What proactive steps have been taken to rectify the situation that we can get an unqualified auditor opinion from the Auditor General? Thank you, Chair.
Okay. So there are two questions. You have temporary staff, but you also have very high overtime payment.
Chair, if I may respond, we've got a bit of a situation in the finance department, specifically the administered revenue section. There are quite a number of staff members who have been assessed and found to not be compatible for the finance department. So at this point, there are about five or six staff members currently in the administered revenue section who are not performing as they should be in terms of their job descriptions, etc. There were performance evaluations done and performance hearings conducted where we had an external chairperson presiding, and the conclusion or outcome of those hearings was that the staff members be redeployed, basically be taken out of the finance department. And to date, finance has been unsuccessful in being able to redeploy them to other divisions or other departments within ICASA. So we are currently sitting with that burden where we've got about six people that are not productive, are not doing what they should be doing, and hence the need to actually make use of temporary staff members, because the six people are currently filling...
That's the fundamental problem we have with this high turnover of senior leadership. Because we should be asking, how did those people get employed in the first place? But you may as well say, look, I found them there. CEO, I found them there. And there's no one to account. Now you're saddled with a problem, with a challenge. If people are employed, but they're incompetent. And so what do you do? I'll go. And yet they're there. They're paid. So we pay for a service twice. Because you have people who are employed, then you also have these outsourced agencies that must perform the task. Repeat, the whole state leadership is not here. We should be directing that to them. That where they employ you, CFO, CEO, capitalists, then we have people who are going to be there for quite some time, so they can be held accountable for what is happening. And we can be able to build a institution. Dr. Rabi.
Just a comment. I think it's very important what you've mentioned. I think the political leadership should be here to answer what are we going to do with the people that are not clear performing as what is expected of them. Because with due respect, Chairman, on this thing I've spoken about, consumers at the end of the day, the cost of monitoring is the fourth highest in Africa. This is the third highest in Africa. And with due respect, it's costing the economy billions and billions of rands, Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, the answers to our questions regarding the financial statements have been so weak. Questions related to human resource management so weak, the responses to service delivery so weak. I'm not surprised that we're the most expensive in the world and almost last in Africa. Why can't we learn from Nigeria? The rhetorical question, I'd expect an answer. If Nigeria can take on MTN, why are they scared? A rhetorical question, no answer required. Chair, I wanted to ask something from the Audit Committee report. There seems to me in the audit committee report at this juncture, if you look on page 63 of the audit committee report, on page 63 you make some very serious findings there which have been referred to, I think, by Dr. George and Mr. Singh. You find deficiencies in the system of internal control. You find audit committee deviations from internal control. And very importantly, you find that matters reported in prior years have not been addressed. Very serious stuff. But then, the disjuncture. On page 64, you find that the quality and content of management and quarterly reports issued are satisfactory. How can that be? How can you find all these major deficiencies with internal control and then these monthly reports which surely must address those deficiencies and what's been done to correct them, have you found those adequate? Can someone explain that contradiction to you, please?
Honourable members, yes. I must say, on reflection, I looked at that. I have seen it again, and there does seem to be a discussion. To try and explain at the time what the thinking was, and maybe it was incorrect in terms of what was said there, but the thinking was from the audit committee that the information presented to us on a quarterly basis was okay. We were satisfied with the information presented to us. It was the content, or rather the ramifications arising from the information presented to us. That was problematic.
But you don't have information in the vacuum. You take the information, then you relate it to the problem. Is the reporting in the monthly reports and quarterly reports, is it addressing the problem? If it's not, you cannot make that finding. And really, sometimes here we get a feeling in this committee that all committees simply go to tick box, tick box, tick box. We don't make a comment on something, so I just, in a sense, give a tick to it. But really, we would appreciate it if you'd, I think, a more honest appraisal with internal control. Because if things are going wrong with internal control, well, then we are lost. You'll repeatedly get qualifications. It's just an appeal.
If I can respond, I take your comment, and I think it's appropriate. If there's an insinuation that we were being dishonest or trying to be dishonest or cover up, that's not the case.
I don't think I made the insinuation. I simply said a tick box mentality. A list of things people do, let's just do them and pick them off. Wasn't making any insinuations. I was saying it's not adequate, this report of yours is not adequate, it's not honest enough. You indicate the problems, you don't get far enough in making judgment on whether your findings are being taken seriously enough or not by management.
There's
no insinuations.
I think we go through a number of reports. And we're very much interested in the report of the audit committee. And I hear your explanation, and it does make sense. But anyone who reads it without you explaining will then get sense that there's a contradiction. And when you look at that paragraph on page 64, we find that basically all audit committees actually constructed exactly that way. It's almost like
It's a template.
So if you don't then give it context vis-a-vis what you now yourself have written on page 63 in terms of your own observation on the general state of internal control, then it appears to be a contradiction. And I think what we want to recommend is that we would want audit committee reports to be as expansive as possible so that they can assist us in oversight. I think if you can take time and look at the audit committee report of Home Affairs, just take the time and go through it. It is quite expansive in terms of giving details, which was very, very useful for us as an oversight board. I think that is the point that is making.
I hope I'm not repeating what Dr. George raised earlier on regarding the license fee, the NRF license fee. The AG finds that accuracy of the NRF license fee was inadequate. It seems to me the problem there is you rely to a great extent on information, financial information you receive from the licensee, am I correct? So my question is then, why are you not independently verifying that the information, which is so important, in order to do your invoicing properly, why are you not independently verifying that the information you're getting from the licensee is correct? If you don't do that, you're then simply accepting anything the licensee gives you. I don't know who's going to answer.
Chair, to some extent he is correct and accurate. We are...
It's so weak and wimpish. Why are you still accepting anything that the licensee gives you?
If I'm allowed to complete what I'm saying, I'll explain why.
Well, because your regulations were vague.
My understanding is that the Act entitles them to request more information. Am I right? In terms of the Act, if I give you certain financial information, you're suspicious of it, it's not enough. In terms of the Act, you can say, give me more. Am I right?
To some extent, we cannot impose obligations on licensees that are to their disadvantage and that result in them incurring additional costs. Because if you look at the regulations that are effective for the 11-12 financial year, as we've explained in detail, it is based on gross profit as a basis to calculate a license fee. So in other words, it entitles the licensees to deduct total direct costs, okay? Total direct costs from your revenue generated from license services.
Let's do this here. You see, comrade, it's like if you go to the old Diamond Act. It was crafted in a way that the mining companies could decide on what happens to them. And that's why earlier on I asked, is that in the Act or is it in the regulation? Who drew the regulation?
They do.
The people sitting there serving the interests of industry instead of...
If I understand the AG correctly, given that you rely on information I supply you, that certain licensees may then produce a zero return. So in other words, the manner in which I submit my financial information to you, the end result could be I say I owe you nothing. Is that correct? And then?
Yeah, it's correct.
So how many of these licensees are getting away without paying anything? How many people are submitting zero returns?
Yeah, quite a few.
Like what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? Any of the big ones?
One or two of the big ones, yeah.
Give us some examples of the big ones.
What are the big ones? I mean, you don't have...
Zero return. That means, am I right, they are not paying any license fees. Because they're able to manipulate the financial statements they give to you.
Yeah.
And you are too weak to take them on, or unprepared to do so. You're hiding behind the regulations.
No, we don't have the resources.
You don't have the what?
Yes.
We don't have the resources.
Yes, of course. That's a weakness. I think let's use it expansively.
Yes.
Yeah. If I could just add to this issue, I think what these general licensee regulations were made in 2009, and they were reflecting the pro-competition dimensions of the Electronic Communications Act, and the idea was that by basing the license fee on profit, then those entities that were not profitable could have a pro-competitive advantage as against the more dominant players such as Vodacom and MTN. The logic was to allow the smaller players who were coming into the market, the internet service providers and so on, to not pay so much or not pay at all when they were in a non-profit situation. Unfortunately, that then coincided with what we detected then as an attempt to game the system. And that's what we've now put a stop to in the new regulations of 2012, which are based on revenue and not on profit. So it was a good faith attempt to act in a pro-competitive way. Unfortunately, it didn't work.
Abused.
Okay.
Just add, the reason why I say it's ambiguous or subject to interpretation is because currently we say licensees are allowed to deduct direct costs, but at the same time, in the regulation itself, we did not include an exhaustive list of what those direct costs should be. So at this point in time, how do we verify something that is not adequately or properly explained?
But if you drew up the regulations, why do you redraw them then? They're your regulations.
Your regulations. Go to Nigeria and see how the Nigerians are doing. She's finally on the point.
Well, no, I suppose she is saying that they have now cut in the regulations. Yeah. What we don't know is whether they are tight enough or they've just taken 1.5 steps. And 3 years down the line, we'll find that there were also other loopholes. Is that exhaustive enough?
Chair, at the same time, in the new regulations, we've included an obligation for licensees to submit to ICASA an audit certificate of confirmation that whatever they are submitting to ICASA is accurate and it's complete.
The whole thing is just a week, they've just, just overpowered the might of Silk C and MTN and all of these others. I think that Mr. Singh had his hand up.
Honourable Singh, you want to make a full
answer? Before I go on to my final question.
Okay, thank you, Honourable Singh. You see, Chairperson, it comes down to what you said earlier on. There's no resources. There's no human resources. Yet we know there are 6 people sitting there who are not fit for purpose. What is going to be done to people that cannot do their jobs within the organization? And I don't want your answer, Chairperson, and outsource or employ consultants to do their job. I mean, this is serious. They're getting performance bonuses, funeral apologies, and all sorts of things. But they're sitting there, right, counting, catching flies, twiddling their thumbs. And we are told, what's going to be done? And second thing, Chair, is there a signed performance agreement between the entity and the CEO, which is something that we picked up the last time? And is it related to KPIs? And does that chain also go down the line from CEO, other employees within the organization? And is there monitoring and evaluation of their performance as one moves forward?
The 6 employees, I think, CFO, you spoke to them briefly and I interrupted you. Exactly what is happening with them? What is it that you're doing with them?
Chair, currently it's my problem, so I've been trying to accommodate them in other positions that are less risky within finance. So to get them away from the administered revenue section, let them be responsible for filing, etc. Yeah. So there's nobody, they're not a division that can absorb them. So I need to solve the problem. Yeah.
My final. I just want to say that this is almost a legacy issue. And it doesn't even come.
I think it is not almost a legacy issue.
It's a legacy issue. It's a legacy issue.
And what we want is because none of you were there.
Yeah.
No one can tell us how those people got employed.
Exactly.
So that's to be our area of interest.
Precisely.
So what we're looking at is what is it that is being done now?
Yeah. Now what has been done right
well,
now?
Let's do this. I think the CFO has responded.
Okay.
Ask the person who's directly responsible.
Okay.
So there can be no answer better than what she has already given.
So earlier on I said that inadequate financial information was being submitted, resulting in zero returns. Inadequate information. Of instances where no financial information at all by the licensees are being submitted. And so therefore no invoices can go out.
Thank you, Chair. The old license operators have been categorized in such a way that those that have not complied in terms of the regulations, the old regulations, for example, there's a process in place to refer them to the CCC, that is the Compliance and Complaints Committee. In other words, we have about a number of about 216 operators out there who have been non-compliant, and there is a process of referring them to the CCC.
AD says 380.
If I make a response, that's according to the last year's audit, the outcome of the 11-12 audit, but during the 12-13 financial year, the License and Compliance Division has undertaken a compliance project where they are now enforcing compliance, and the outcome of that project, it went back as far as the band error or inception of the license, or when the licensee was awarded the license.
216.
Yeah, but the number has come down significantly. So, yeah, currently in the 12-13 financial year, we've been able to collect financial information that was outstanding, not just for the 12-13 financial year, but going back to inception of the license, to or award of the license for about, I think it's about six or five years, going back, where we've been able to collect financial information and account for it in the 12-13 financial year, together with the prior year adjustments where it's reflected. So the numbers come down, so currently it's about 200, yeah, just over 200 licensees that are categorized as non-compliant, in that they haven't submitted financial information and haven't complied in other areas. And those licensees are now being submitted to the Complaints and Compliance Committee.
Finally, have you able to estimate your loss of revenue, loss of license fees, in terms of those who are submitting zero returns and those who are not submitting any financial information and who you are unable to invoice? Have you been able to categorize that as a loss to ICASA in terms of your categories?
Chair, I believe you're collecting from all the major or the big operators. They make up 99% of the revenue that we invoice for the EDS, ECNS licensees. What we've realized from this exercise that has been conducted by the License and Compliance Division is that the non-compliant licensees, or those licensees that were not submitting financial information since the extension of their licenses, the amounts that we've now collected are very immaterial. The bulk of those licensees we found, once they've submitted financial information now, are subject to the 30 million exemption, meaning the revenue that they generate is below the line, below 13 million. So in those cases, they're not subjected to a license fee. We've been able to collect just over 10 million for the 11-12 year and the past 5-6 years. So it's not very material at all.
Chair, my question on the infamous six, not answered yet, what's going to happen? And then, no, just so before we forget, and the agreement, the CEO and the...
Oh, yeah.
Thank you, Chair. On the agreement between the CEO and the council, the agreement is in place. There's also a revised one for this current year that is also being under consideration. With respect to cascading it downward to the general manager, that process has also unfolded. And then monitoring and evaluation, we have not yet started on the full assessment.
It looks like they're stuck with the Magnificent Six. But I see that at the end of the financial year under review, you had an acting human resources manager as well as legal, and I don't know what Kusi means. Do we have permanent people there or we still have acting people? Because I would imagine those two will be central to dealing with this salaries issue. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair. On both instances, the HR and legal, they're still active. Maybe just a bit of background. The council was an agreed approach that the organization will realign itself. And in terms of the outcome of that, the realigned process will then dictate whether you require people to operate at a particular level. So that process hasn't been concluded yet. So hence
when will it be concluded and why is it not being concluded?
Well, the reason why it's not being concluded, there was an issue around funding the actual project. That's number one. Number two is that the service provider is supposed to be appointed before, if I'm not mistaken, before the end of...
So the process is not started actually?
It's not started.
Chair, why?
To be quite honest, it should have started, but because of the lack of funding and the process that we're looking at, especially after the AG report, we had to expedite that crisis management. And when that was done, then we also have interviewed already, I think, the HR person. We are in the process now of shortlisting. We are also in the process of finding a person who will help us with the realignment process. And that is almost at its latest, you know, stage of development. So all these things, you are right, you know, would like to expedite them, but the tyranny of time and space, it, sometimes these things cannot be done quickly as we would like to
well, I would imagine that
they... And there is also the element, when they come on board, then they will also help us with the skills inventory of the people we are having, so that we can place them accordingly.
Which you currently don't have.
Yeah.
And I'm sure there is no adequate human resource policy.
Exactly. No, the human resource policies are now in place because we brought...
How do they talk to the situation? How they talk to the situation of the sick people? Because I'm struggling to accept that they will be stuck with people who can't perform. Until they die.
One of our... remember, too, that we are operating in an area that is union, you know, driven. So you cannot just terminate people carelessly. You know,
I'm not suggesting that.
Yeah, so what
we are... I don't understand the labor law to be saying,
yeah,
don't fire anybody.
Yeah, so what we are trying to do is to use our ingenuity and find ways of either redeploying these people or retraining them in certain areas that will come out as we move into the realignment.
No, that's fine. Let me go to convenient room. But I don't believe that the law says you cannot fire anybody who doesn't perform. I don't think so. So, I would have been interested to hear from the human resource manager if he or she was here, or the legal person.
Thank you, sir. Mine is short and from the consultant. The people, you said, consultants were employed to assist with the re-upload of the trust transactions to clear the misallocation of transactions process from the system in past. I just want to check how long is this consultant going to assist you, and how much they pay that consultant. And I want to check the issue of skills transfer in the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. The consultant in question, we got on board in January, so they've been assisting us now for about 4 months, or just over 4 months, until we submitted our financials on the 31st of May. The value of the contract is just under R1 million, and skill transfer was a condition in the contract where they are assisting us with ensuring that a similar situation does not occur again during the course of next year. And they're also skill transfer to our IT department and the IT people that provide the JDE support to the finance unit. We've also arranged a debriefing session where the consultant will come and give us feedback on what they picked up during the exercise and the necessary controls to implement to avoid such occurrences in the future.
All right, thank you very much, comrades. What has happened to one understand that the supply chain manager was under suspension pending investigation. Where are we on that one?
Thank you, Chair. Where we are is that for the second, there has been, a disciplinary process that has followed.
The investigation is completed.
It's not yet complete. We are at a stage where we have another cycle of engagement with the respected person.
That's too telegraphic. I'm not getting. So the person is still under suspension.
Yes, he is under suspension.
But then you had a disciplinary process.
Yeah, we initially suspended the supply chain manager in on 7th of September 2012, and then he took the organization to the CCMA, and subsequently withdrew his case from the CCMA.
I see you have been losing a number of CCMA cases.
Yeah.
I think that reflects this lack of the legal process. Like we just get this into jail. Suspended, thrown out. Very good, this is CCMA, we have egg on our face.
Sorry, Chair, I was saying that the suspended supply chain did go to the CCMA, but subsequently withdrew his case from the CCMA to go through a normal disciplinary process. That's what has happened.
I see. there was also a process to acquire a service provider to investigate supply management, supply chain management department, generally. Has that service provider been acquired? And or where are we?
Chair, we are busy, it's still going through the procurement process. We have received calls or quotations from various companies, and we will be conducting an evaluation during the course of this week to appoint a service provider.
Precisely because your internal audit is incapacitated.
We have paid officials, but they are really a shadow of where the rail work is being done. And the rail work is being done, it seems to me, increasingly by consultants. An unfair observation.
Yes, you.
Thank you, Chair. I think on the case of the supply chain, there is a somebody who has been temporarily employed to continue work. Yes, the observation is correct because it's a temporary.
Just switch on your mic, comrade.
Correct that you're relying increasingly now on consultants to do a range of activities which you already paid for to do.
Thank you, I was responding to specifically the...
No, that's fine. He's making a general observation. Your response noted is correct, but he's making a general observation that there seem to be a growing reliance on consultants. Maybe precisely because we have people who may not have the requisite skills. And you're asking, is that an unfair comment or observation? It's a fair comment. Why should it be so? Because if you have an increase in consultants, it means we're actually going backwards as an institution in terms of developing and building capacity to do things ourselves, for which we have created positions, for which we have employed people, for which we could get bonuses.
Thank you, Chair. I think the intention to the organizational realignment is to try to address some of the either problems or challenges within the organization, because the issue of skills is not necessarily in finance, it's across
organization. People are appointed to actually deal with the challenges of the organization. I mean, you are the CEO, she is the CFO, he is the chairperson. Your responsibility is to deal with the challenges of the organization.
So if your challenge is to must then run to consultants, then what's the point of our being there? I think that's the essence of WATRA. Because if we have positions for which we have employed people, those people must deal with the challenges of the organization. We don't find it acceptable that institutions, but the compensation fund. I mean, we felt like we were wasting time talking to the people. We should have called the consultants because they're the ones who are running the show.
Honorable Chair, I think your point is highly well taken. And we are going to try, especially in this realignment processes, after we have done that skills inventory, we'll then know exactly, you know, what we have internally and what we do not have, you know, and if we need to increase our budget, we'll also present our case to the DOC and also to PCC. I know they are already sympathetic to us when it comes to that matter. They know that ICASA is indeed a weak regulator, you know, and one of the weaknesses is because of, you know, the skills shortage. But we are now trying to face this matter head on.
All right. Well, let's hope you indeed face it head on. I see. Okay. You.
Chair, I just wanted to, if you permit, if members can just look at page 98, note number 9. I think where the question was raised around consultancy fee and so forth. It is quite clear that there is a decline in as far as the total expenditure, besides the fact that we did acknowledge the previous speaker's in observation.
All right.
The current situation, but the way I'm hearing is their plan to employ more. That's what I'm hearing next year. The figures decreased since last year, but if I listen to you this time next year, it'll be much bigger than that. If I'm hearing correctly.
I have to clarify, because we not want you to leave here with a take that you...
Chair, if I may, I think we referred to the use of consultants for the forensic investigation being conducted in the supply chain division.
Also for the re-engineering and what.
Yes. Supply chain, as you are well aware, is a very specialized area, so I felt it necessary to rather get the experts into the system.
Because you don't have experts in your internal audit. Goes back to that.
Sorry, Mark, I'll say something. I don't think that internal audit expertise is the right expertise to be used in conducting investigations. Because the investigation normally leads to some sort of tribunal, be it an internal disciplinary hearing, ending up in court, internal audit people are not trained or skilled in the laws of evidence and having to give evidence. And if you allow internal audit to do an investigation, that investigation could ultimately lead to an inappropriate decision being reached because the people are not skilled in evidence. Added to which, if internal audit goes in to do an investigation into the supply chain management unit as an example, and which is pretty much a witch hunt, it's an investigative process, and then a month later, say, well, we, for internal audit, we're coming to do an internal audit of your unit to assist you to improve control. It also taints internal audit. That's my own view, okay? But just, I want to share that.
Okay. All right. That's not it. I'll not go into that. I take the correct part of your point, and I'll leave the other part. Because this is his investigation. As an outcome of the fact that the horse has already bolted out of the stable and the people were supposed to be gatekeeping. I just not there. Hush, before we close.
Yes, as we move towards closing, I just wanted to take the monitoring part of the department itself over this particular entity. I know that earlier it was like they were going to check whether also monitoring helps to go and check whether they are doing monitoring over the ICA itself. I think to me it's a key check, because the portfolio committee and ourselves, we are coming after them. They are the ones who are, you know, regularly have to receive reports in relation to performance, challenges and then success of ICASA, and look at areas that required some level of amendments, if these amendments have to be required.
How does the department monitor its entities, including and also, especially specifically ICASA?
Thank you, Jen. There is a dedicated unit within the department.
And I imagine that the head of that unit should have been here, so that when we ask these questions, we don't get generalized responses, but somebody will say, I work with these people on a day-to-day basis. I heard you making an assertion earlier on that the department and the ministry are doing everything in their powers to assist these people, but they are not pulling their weight. I would have loved us to go into the detail of that statement with somebody who say, these are my reports, these are the statements we're making, these people are not coming to the party. That would have been much, much more helpful. But anyway, continue.
There is a dedicated unit within the department dealing with oversight. Throughout the year, from the time when the entity develops the strategy to the alignment of the entity strategy with the department, to monitoring of the quarterly reports against the target, to looking at the financial performance against whatever that the entity would have presented. Whatever the issues, Honorable Chair, that are picked up in the reports, quarterly reports, are raised with the, an analysis will be conducted for the minister to indicate the red flags. There are bilateral meetings where the council and executive of ICASA will then come to discuss the issues, where the minister gives the directive in terms of how the entity should move forward. I did mention earlier on that it's one thing to do the recommendations, and of course the execution comes at a different issue. I must indicate, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, that whilst the entity attempts to implement some of the issues that are raised, it's not at all times that those things are done. And it becomes very difficult because there is a full-time council, there are executives, and unfortunately it becomes the responsibility of those that are there to ensure that those things are implemented. But from time to time, these issues are raised either from the annual report, the outcomes of the annual report, and one of the things that I have mentioned before this committee, Honorable Chair, to address precisely some of the challenges that we cover. The minister has initiated a clean audit process to precisely deal with some of these challenges. And on top of the list of that process is the SABC as well as ICASA, because of the audit issues that they have not been able to resolve over the years. So these issues, Honorable Chair and Honorable Member, they are raised from time to time, but the only challenge is around execution of some of these directives.
Okay.
I also want to beg our DG that especially now, there is constant interaction between ICASA and DOC, and because of that, there's been vast improvement. We're not there yet, but at least, you know, the lines of communication are now wide open. Just recently we had a ministerial meeting where all the sectors that operate under were there, and it was a very fruitful development. And this was followed again by another meeting, and now we have almost a program of action that we are going to...
No, we want that reflected in the annual report, the outcome of the annual report. That is what will give meaning. Otherwise, it will just be a get-together. I have three questions myself. I was reading somewhere and one of these companies was accusing ICASA of being unable to verify its own information about who owes it money. Is it still that issue around, well, we depend on the licensees to supply us with information, and
whatever they supply us, that becomes a basis of our decision, which you now say has now been corrected. Was that the basis of your wrangle with the Vodacom? No, that was something else. Because I see reports to say you actually went to court to try and set aside your own decision. How did that, how do you explain that? You went to court to have the court set aside your own decision.
Well,
just sit on the mic.
I think the issue pertaining to Vodacom, we have, I spoke to the CEO of Vodacom, and we agreed that there can be an amicable, you know, solution to this matter.
Meaning that they were not wrong, and you
were meaning that we are also not wrong. But now the legal people are going to look at how this situation can be solved. I'm not trying to say that we're not right or we are wrong, but there is still a conflict, but we are moving towards reaching a solution to that.
No, that's fine. You see,
yeah.
My area of interest is the origin of this conflict. It arises from decisions that you took, and the question is how informed were those decisions. That's why now you find yourself in a position where you can't categorically say we are right. Will enforce these obligations on you.
Well, your point is highly well taken. I think the process of solving this situation between us and Vodacom was ill-defined, but we are trying to rectify that.
What about WBS?
WBS is another saga that is hanging on, and we are also trying to reach a workable solution. But now that this is...
Are they home?
No, I couldn't say that right now. Because
Are you right? Are you sure that you are right?
I couldn't comment on that because the situation is just sub judice.
No, right or wrong, I don't think that affects the sub judice rule.
Yeah.
But you think ICASA has a case, we're right. We're 100% sure.
We think we're right thus far. But because the issue is sub judice, I don't want to give you certainty and say we're right, only to find that there's one little loophole.
Is that a product of regulatory uncertainty or ambiguity, which allows everyone to be right and nobody to be wrong?
Well, regulatory issues, the law itself and also the spirit of the law, sometimes it's not interpreted in the same way always. And so even Paja states that. So there's going to be a lot of movement along those lines. But from our standpoint, we act on a position that we are right until we are proven otherwise.
Is it correct that this WBS company was authorized to roll out 3 sites, but that they actually rolled over 300 sites?
I am told by our...
And that they were granted authorization for 4 links, but they had rolled out over 700 links.
Well, I think one of our councillor here who deals with engineering can answer that much.
But anyway, those are just detailed examples, but overall, I was just saying WPS, you have a case with them, and you say it's still hanging up there. And I think it goes back to what Comrade Trevor was saying, about being firm and robust, knowing right from wrong, knowing when you are right, and when you are right, enforcing what is there. I think we need to do much better than this. Give us the comfort that they're in charge. I think I think that's the comfort one to get out of this room having. That we have a council that is in charge, that is able to enforce compliance. All right. Chairperson, Mafu, Lebo.
Well, Chair, Honourable Chair, and Honourable Members of, so I think all the questions that you asked today, they really elevate our mind. When we go back, we shall try and attempt to answer all the questions, those that we can do quickly. We shall make sure that you receive an informed opinion regarding that. Including this case of WBS, we will be able to tell you exactly how many were illegal and how many were not illegal, and what have we done thus far. And that is why I was a bit hesitant to give you figures, only to find that they may be distorted. But the engineering department will have that, and I know also the financial people who are very closely aligned to this will have that. But on the whole, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of SCOR, this is my first time to appear in this body. And I can assure you the questions and the caliber of interaction that we have had with you is certainly going to make ICASA a better organization. And I do want to admit that we found ICASA with some strength but a lot of weaknesses. At this juncture, my CEO, for instance, when we started, he was managing 25 people, if I'm not mistaken, both operational and also the regulatory staff. So can you imagine the burden that sat on him? And then to top that, you had 9 councillors who are there full time. What were they doing then, if you have that, except bringing maybe a lot of conflict between the management hierarchy and, you know, the council element. So we embarked on looking at other agencies elsewhere, other regulatory bodies. And one of the ones that we adopted was the one that is almost like a hybrid of FCC. We have not concluded that yet, but we use that on what was called interim structure, where I said all the regulatory issues will then now, will henceforth be managed by these councillors, but only at an oversight basis, not at an operational basis. And indeed, this caused a lot of confusion, because managers did not understand their role well, and other councillors also did not understand their role, nor did I. But that was a very healthy process, because if one compares and contrasts where ICASA AG report was and where we can be now, I think there's been a vast improvement. So we cherish this, and as I say, I still admit that we are a weak organization. But today, you could never read a paper in 1 week without seeing ICASA featuring, either negatively or positively. That means we are now a vibrant organization that cannot be dismissed easily. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. CEO, VFO, wish all the best in getting all the issues that we're discussing here. Bye. And the Auditor General's Office, as always, thank you very much for your presence. National Treasurer, I always say you may have a lazy day in the office, but you never know. Something might have arisen that needed your critical input to see after.
We thank you for having made time to be with us. Comrades, tomorrow is group meeting. I'm sure there are a couple of reports that we need to process through. Thank you very much. Our engagement for today is over.
This is the word. Hello. Are you not ready?
Yeah.
That was quick. Are you going to the office?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I walk fast. I don't know whether... I just... You got a bullet?